You know, what we want to do is build long-term relationships with people who feel really passionately about fashion, as passionately as we feel about fashion. And if those are kind of at the micro or mid-tier end, that's great. You know, we'll work with them, we'll build relationships with them. And so our focus this year is very much on building an extremely strong pipeline of ASOS talent.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. I've got Dan Elton on the show today, the Chief Marketing and Customer Officer at ASOS. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Connor, great to see you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm so glad we got to do this live. It was fun meeting you in London in person. I'm really excited for what you're going to do with the brand. It sounds like you guys have really big plans.
Yeah, it's an incredibly exciting time to be joining. I mean, it's been something of a turnaround for the brand and for the business. It's like many e-commerce businesses coming out of COVID, incredibly exciting times ahead for the next few years.
I want to hit your background and go through all your history because I think there's so much leading into this. You've only just started at ASOS fairly recently, but now that you've gone through the kind of planning process, you kind of understand the landscape. Like you said, you've just had your first call with analysts recently with the markets. I'm curious, what is the plan?
Yeah, you know, last year, so I've been at ASOS for 7 months, and I joined halfway through a year, which was about stabilizing the brand, rebuilding the balance sheet, refreshing the leadership team. And that was a really exciting thing to be part of. And, you know, for me, I wanted to get in at the ground floor of this new phase for ASOS. I've walked into turnaround strategies halfway through, and it's not nearly as fun as when you get in at the ground floor and you can be part of a team who are kind of really bonding. And so I was really excited to join Jose and the rest of the leadership team here. So as I say, last year was mostly, you know, Jose's strategy to kind of, you know, rebuild the balance sheet, which we've done, refresh the leadership and take a bit of cost out of the business. This year is about getting the business back to a position where we can grow again. And for us, that means a bunch of things. But some of the things that it means, I think particularly interesting for you and your listeners, are about really rebuilding our customer journey around fashion, you know, really getting back to the essence of what our brand is about. And moving beyond just being a kind of performance advertiser, which is where ASOS has been kind of recently, for good reason, but that's where it's been recently. And so that's the bit that I guess I'm most excited about. There are lots of other parts of our strategy. You know, we have a unique perspective on styling. I mean, you know, for listeners who don't know ASOS, we are a very strong mixture between a bunch of strong own brands like ASOS Design and Topshop, but, you know, third-party brands too, like Nike and Carhartt and Adidas and many others. And so we have this kind of unique perspective on what style and fashion means. You often find kind of mono brands or just third-party branded retailers, but we do something a little bit different. So yeah, the strategy is built on a number of things, but those are the two that probably excite me the most.
Yeah, it's got to be fun to get back to really kind of brand building, right? Because, you know, not that performance marketing doesn't have its merits, of course it does. But I think that you're sitting on this kind of treasure trove of history and opportunity and product to be able to go out and tell those stories in a way that gets back to what I think gets most marketers excited, right?
Right.
That's got to be fun to do.
Incredibly so. And I think one of the reasons I joined ASOS was because, you know, ASOS is 20 years old now, or there or thereabouts. And so it is kind of a first wave e-commerce business. And those, you know, you will know a lot of kind of founders and marketers who were involved in those early e-commerce businesses. And they were all built like ASOS on, you know, really strong social marketing, really strong earned media, really strong cultural marketing. And so there is that history at ASOS. And then what happened was, you know, 2018, 2019, as the e-commerce market was really booming, and then into COVID, when it kind of skyrocketed, the brand pivoted to being really a performance-only retailer, which was kind of natural. You know, there were millions of new customers in the kind of e-commerce space. And so that's understanding. It can be really seductive just to focus on those kind of short-term returns that performance advertising gives you. But again, the market's moved on again, you know, and we need to kind of rebuild that brand moat that ASOS did have and was really good at. And that's the focus for me and the team here.
Yeah, we had one of the founding partners of Forerunner Ventures who also got started around that time and really kind of helped to fund a lot of those first direct-to-consumer, e-com, performance-driven brands. And I think what's been interesting is there was definitely an opportunity there for growth, but I think those brands have largely struggled big time on the public markets, right? These direct-to-consumer brands. So I love to see this kind of return to, I mean, that's if you think about all of the brands that have been built that have lasted, you know, 50, 80, 100 years, there's rich heritage, there's rich storytelling. It's a lot of brand building there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I tend to oversimplify things, but I think the world of fashion particularly is split between what you can call retailer brands and product brands. And retail brands, you know, we're very good at like operations, supply chain, maybe tech, but lack a brand moat. And, you know, then you've got those kind of product brands that were obviously excellent at the product experience, brand building. And a lot of those brands that I think you're talking about are kind of have been retail brands, and they've been built through performance, and they haven't necessarily focused on building that brand moat. You know, ASOS was very strong at that in the early days, but that's what we're trying to do now, is kind of rebuild that again.
Well, let's go to your background, because I want people to have context for kind of how you got here and how you think about things. So interestingly, right, you didn't start on the apparel side, right? So your original time was at, you know, Deloitte on the consulting side. Then you spent close to a decade in the grocery sector. I'm curious, talk to me. I actually don't know a lot about the grocery sector. I'd love to know what attracted you to that sector. Maybe what are some of the surprise learnings about how does the grocery sector market itself? Like, again, you're, you know, 7 months into ASOS, you spent 10 years there. I'm curious what you learned during that time.
Right. It's a great question. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. My friends are a lot more interested now I work in fashion than they were when I worked in grocery. But I could talk about grocery all day. So yeah, like you say, I started in consulting. You know, it was a classic experience. It was like learning all the frameworks, learning how to kind of learn the guts of an industry very quickly. When you're in your early 20s, that's kind of fun, you know, but eventually the airport lounges and hotels, kind of the fun of that wears off. And I found myself working in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I don't know if you've ever been to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. It's the 10th biggest city in Arkansas. And we're doing a project in a factory, actually, which was bizarre. Don't ask how a London-based management consultant ended up in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, but I did. And I was like, you know what? It is incredible to be in a factory rather than actually just writing PowerPoint presentations all day. So I vowed to myself, when I got back from Pine Bluff, I was going to go and find a real job. And
a real job.
Yeah, a real job. Yeah, exactly. A real job. So, I'd mostly worked in media, the media industry up to that point. And I was going for a job at a big media player in the UK. And I thought, I'll go for interview practice at Tesco. Had no interest in joining, but, you know, I'd been talked into it by a recruiter and, you know, thought I'd join. And honestly, you asked the question, what attracted me to grocery? What attracted me in the first instance was, for the first time in my career, I met someone who was a super inspirational leader, someone who thought very deeply about people and people development and the possibilities for them. And so I never even went to that other interview. I just, you know, I said yes straight away. I went through, I think, another interview round, one more, just one. And I went to work for him. And honestly, I never looked back. And grocery is just the most incredible place to learn. You know, if you're working in big box grocery, the ability to execute quickly is remarkable. You know, you can make a change today in the morning, and you can see the impact of that change in the afternoon. So I think that for me was incredibly seductive. Like, you know, I've got a lot of friends who work in marketing and came up through the FMCG route or the beauty brand route, you know, and they could spend 18 months maybe working on a campaign. Obviously times are different now in the kind of e-commerce and digital.
Yeah.
But you know, if you were working at Unilever at that point, you know, you would spend a long time working on your campaigns, building your brand. And that obviously has merit, but in the grocery sector, you've got Christmas, and then you're straight out Christmas into Valentine's Day, and then you're straight out of Valentine's Day into Easter. And then you're straight out of Easter into Mother's Day, Father's Day, the summer, back to school. And then you've maybe got three or four brand campaigns peppered in between. And so you're literally running, you know, 10 to 15 campaigns a year. So, you know, on the one hand, it was execution and the ability to see things changing at scale. On the other hand, it was the speed, which was really, really exciting for, you know, I was in my kind of mid-20s at the time. That was really exciting. But honestly, the other thing was, you know, as I said at the start, the leadership element and being able to work with just incredible leaders. And the best leaders that I've worked for have all worked in grocery at some point, because you are very early on in your career leading hundreds and thousands of people. You know, if you're a store manager and it's a big box retailer, you can be, you know, in your mid, late 20s and managing 1,000 people. And so you have to learn how to motivate people, how to sell a vision, how to influence, how to deal with underperformance. And I'd never seen that in consulting. Consulting was an amazing experience, but it was not famous for great coaches, great leaders, and grocery really was. Mm-hmm. What drove me to leave grocery, Connor, just quickly, was actually, as I'd kind of moved into the marketing space, I had this realization after 2 or 3 years that actually what drives people to shop, particularly in physical retail, is how close they live to the store. And you have the ability to influence about 2% of a grocer's customers into switching or changing. So actually, the reason I left grocery wasn't because I fell out of love with it or any reason like that. It was just because as a marketer, you can have a really limited impact over your brand.
We love the 2% change you've driven. Thank you so much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That is fascinating. I guess that makes sense logically, right? You just go to the one that's most convenient to you.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely in my neighborhood, we do go to the one that is technically the closest, which is interesting, but we do have 3 options that are within a couple of minutes of each other. And so I feel like within that, like there's some real decision. It's like we've got Safeway, Whole Foods, and Trader Joe's, right? And they're all within a minute or two of each other. But yeah, that makes sense generally. And I think to your point, just thinking through kind of what a grocery business is like, I mean, the number of brands, the number of categories, the number of choices, the number, it just operationally sounds like a good learning ground, right? A good testing ground as well.
Incredibly so. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Just to hit on grocery, one last thing, because I do think it's, frankly, it's relevant to me. I'm sure it'd be relevant to other people. So you went through a fairly massive integration of 2 businesses, so Argos and Sainsbury's businesses. I'm curious, you know, for others that might go through that kind of merger or acquisition, what would be your advice to them? What did you learn from that? What was that part of your experience like?
Yeah, that was an amazing experience, actually. So, you know, what happened to me was I decided to leave Tesco and go and join Argos. And a lot of your listeners, I think, probably won't know Argos. It's a UK-based general merchandise retailer, and then had a very successful pivot into essentially omnichannel retail, like click and collect retail. That was my kind of first experience of a proper turnaround. And then it got bought by Sainsbury's, which is, you know, the second biggest grocer. So I went from essentially working for the biggest grocer in the UK to the second biggest grocer in the UK. The biggest learning for me was focusing on cost synergies versus revenue synergies. So I think if you are part of a management team that does a piece of, you know, very large M&A, the temptation is to focus all the organization's effort on getting the cost synergies out. If you're a public business, that is what you're going to be reporting on, and that is where you're going to be measured. And I fully understand the importance of that. But actually, you know, the strategic case for Sainsbury's to buy Argos was the revenue synergies. It was the kind of sharing of the customer bases. It was the cross-selling. It was some of the interesting stuff we could have done there. And it took us almost 3 years to get to that, 2.5 years to get to that. And so, you know, I think I would have prioritized that more quickly. I think the second thing, and this is not anything that you won't, you know, either have experienced yourself or your listeners won't have heard about, but, you know, culture and the danger of being kind of eaten alive. Mm. Even in 2 businesses that were quite large, you know, Argos was a £4-5 billion revenue business. Sainsbury's obviously much bigger than that, but, you know, maybe 20 billion, 15, 20 billion. But they had very different cultures, and it didn't take long for one to overwhelm the other. And what made Argos quite a magical place, a place that had survived a really brutal turnaround and had quite a lot of entrepreneurialism and, you know, kind of speed to impact, that kind of got lost quite quickly. And so if I was going through that again, I'd love to think about how to preserve some of those and maybe almost kind of reverse engineer them into the acquiring organization. But yeah, it was a super interesting time.
Yeah. We went through almost a very similar, much smaller scale, obviously, kind of integration. And those are similar challenges, right? Where it's like, okay, hey, you know, we're 40% of the business, you're 60% of the business. How do these 2 cultures meld? And the thing is, the new culture that emerges will be a new culture, right? It won't be the same as either of them previously. But how do you do it in a way that doesn't feel like you're losing that culture, right? Doesn't feel like you're losing that entrepreneurialism that maybe you had previously. It's a challenge. And again, ours has been a very successful combination. It's gone very, very well for all the reasons that we thought it would. But it's a challenge. It's not for the faint of heart, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when the faces are still the same, you know, you can kid yourself that everything stays the same, that the culture stays the same. But I think that can change very quickly. And some people adapt very quickly and others don't. I think that can be really exciting to be part of that, but it can also be quite a dangerous moment for the success or failure, I think, of that activity.
Yeah, 100%. So you mentioned, so you leave grocery, you're like, I want to have an impact from a marketing perspective. Interestingly, you went to the technology side, so you went to Google. I'm curious, what made you decide to shift to technology after spending, you know, so much time on the retail side or on the grocery side?
Well, I mean, honestly, it was mostly about personal growth. So I'd spent 10 years working in grocery and general merchandise, predominantly in physical retail, but a little bit in e-commerce. And, you know, I was starting to think about taking a CMO role, and I kind of felt I wasn't qualified to really work in the omnichannel future. You know, Argos was very interesting business. It was mostly e-commerce, but, you know, in both of the grocery businesses I worked in, e-commerce was something of an afterthought, even though in absolute terms, they had very big e-commerce businesses. So when the opportunity came up to go to work at Google, it was a no-brainer. You know, it was a huge adjustment. You know, I went from leading very large teams, from working in an organization where, as I said before, you can make change happen very quickly and you can see that change happening very quickly, to an organization where really no one manages very large teams at Google until you're extremely, extremely senior, and where actually change can take a lot of time because, you know, the risks associated with change at Google are enormous. And some things happen very quickly at Google, but I worked in the London office and it's a West Coast-based tech business. And so, you know, change can be a little bit more incremental and a bit slower. But it was an incredible experience. I was there for 3 years. I joined in Black Friday week 2019. I had 4 months getting to know my team, visiting my clients all around the world. And then COVID hit. And I spent the next 2.5 years working out of my spare room. But I couldn't have thought of a better place to be. It was amazing.
Yeah. And you were working primarily with the fashion and apparel sectors, right, while you were at Google?
Yeah. So Google has a sales org. I mean, yep. A lot of advertisers don't really feel like Google has a sales org because it never really feels, I mean, it doesn't feel like you're working with salespeople a lot of the time. The product market fit is such that it's not a hard sell. But Google has a very large sales team. I worked in the large customer part of that. And my clients were, or my team's clients were, mostly global fashion, sportswear, and luxury players. So, you know, ASOS was one of my clients, Nike outside of the US and Adidas and, you know, some really amazing brands.
That had to be a great way to, you know, you get to observe them, right? Like that's something that we get that I really enjoy is, you know, we're talking to some of the smartest brands in the world and you get to, you know, watch what they're doing, observe them, teach them, right, about something that you understand hopefully better than they do. I'm curious, in between kind of Google and ASOS, you had a short stint at Made.com. It looks like it was a particularly challenging environment, right? You know, obviously you had all the supply chain disruptions, volatile market, et cetera. And I think Made.com went into administration, I believe, right? So what was that experience like? Again, you know, short experience, 6 months of your life, you know, I think you kind of stepped into the storm a little bit. What was that like?
Just before I tell you about Made, I mean, you literally took the words out of my mouth there, Connor, about Google. You know, the reason I went there as someone who kind of always wants to really make a career on the brand side was the opportunity to like form a thesis of what a good CMO looks like. Mm. You know, and you work with probably hundreds of CMOs. I was working with maybe 20, 25 at a time. But it was that opportunity to really observe what good and maybe, you know, not so good CMOs were doing that was, you know, the opportunity. So that was why I went there. So yeah, your question was about Made and my experience in Made. And I mean, man, I could talk about it. It was 6 months and I could probably talk about it for 6 months. It was,
not a lot of sleep.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was the first time in my career that my health, my mental health really suffered. It was a rocky road. It was the saddest professional experience of my life. But it was also the greatest learning experience. And for those who don't know Made was a UK-based European pure play furniture retailer. It was about 10 years old when it went into administration, 10, 12 years old maybe, and had really grown strongly and then rocketed during COVID. And it'd taken that opportunity to IPO. So it IPO'd in the summer of 2021 and I joined them in about March time, 2022. And when I agreed to join, they were growing at 30%. Like I said, they just IPO'd. They had 100 and something million in the bank. And then after I worked my notice at Google, they were shrinking at 30% a year and burning through that cash. And so it was a real head-spinning moment for everyone in the business. It was a head-spinning moment for me personally, because obviously it wasn't quite what I thought I was walking into. But I decided to stay and really thought there was, you know, through that kind of 6-7 month period that I was there, really thought there was a possible future because the business and the brand was incredible. I mean, we talked a little bit before about brand moats, and Made had an unbelievable brand moat for particularly kind of urban European consumers in their kind of 20s and 30s. Made was the place to buy furniture. There are still like young professionals in London walking around looking lost because they don't know where to buy their furniture to furnish their flats, their apartments, now that business has folded. So it really had a very, very strong following. So, I mean, what did I learn? So many things. I think, without being too technical, I think the most important thing I learned was about unit economics and really understanding your unit economics and not waiting until it rains to get your unit economics in order. Made had never made a profit because it had very high acquisition costs. And it was always, you know, like loads of businesses that you'll be familiar with. It was always the view of the management team that, hey, look, if we ever need to pivot to profitability, we just reduce our acquisition costs and we'll be fine. But of course, you know, all of this was happening in Q1, Q2, 2022 with the Ukraine war kicking off. Mm. And there was huge supply chain disruption. So even though we managed to pivot out of a lot of marketing, that cost was just replaced by supply chain disruption. So I guess that was the first thing. I think the second thing, never rely on a single paradigm. And I know that that maybe sounds easier than it is, but you know, Made had a single distribution channel and we found ourselves with way too much stock. You know, it took us too long to work out actually other ways to shift it. So I think unit economics, having multiple paradigms and ways to do business. And then the other one, and it's a real cliche, but just work with people that inspire you. You know, I think a lot of people would have expected me to walk out of Made, having found what I found within the first couple of months. I think a lot of people would, and I probably in many situations I would have done, but I was working for really one of the most inspiring people I've worked for. She was, you know, Nicola Thompson, incredible CEO. And the management team was by far and away the most functional that I'd worked with, even during an incredibly difficult time, huge levels of respect, challenge, trust. And so the learning experience of working with those folks was just too good to turn down. And yeah, we really thought we could save it, but unfortunately not. It now does have a home with Next. They bought the brand and the IP, but sadly Made as it was is no more.
I mean, you wonder how much of that was even avoidable, right? Because obviously, you know, during the pandemic, everybody's working from home like you are, right? I think there was a massive spike in almost all home material buying generally, right? Furniture, et cetera. And then that dropped off, right? In 2022 as well. So you wonder how much of it's cyclical as well, just like bad timing.
Yeah, it's a real lesson for all of us about, like, you know, what sustainable growth looks like.
Yeah, I think I've talked to at least three or four executives, and almost all of them were retail executives. I think they were all like retail executives who went through, like, were at some company that had to essentially go through bankruptcy because of COVID, right? Because you had this, I'm in store, I'm out of store, I'm in store, I'm out of store, supply chain. It was a disaster, right? So let's get back to ASOS really quickly. And I'd love to hit on, obviously, the people that listen to this are coming from us primarily. So, you know, they are interested in the creator economy, influencers, et cetera. And I know particularly in the kind of the fast fashion sector, there's had a huge impact across, you know, Fashion Nova, Boohoo, and Pretty Little Thing have obviously leaned in. Zara and H&M are leaning in pretty aggressively. And again, obviously ASOS is a different beast in some ways. But I'm curious, how are you guys approaching very specifically the kind of influencer marketing and creator space? And what do you think are some of the opportunities there?
I mean, this is a space where there's huge upside for ASOS, but we may not be able to kind of teach your listeners, particularly your more experienced listeners, anything massively innovative. Because actually, like I said at the start, you know, ASOS is focused so much on lower funnel performance advertising that it's really neglected the opportunity in the creator and influencer and earned media space. So, you know, how are we approaching it? So I think we're thinking about it in a few ways. I think the first thing, and, you know, shameless plug here, you know, we're building muscle, we're building capability. We've got loads of open roles in that space for people who work in social, influencers, creators, PR. So we are building the team. And I think that's super important to me. One of the things that I learned from you and others was that this is something, you know, you can do with a bit of help, but you've really got to do yourself.
Yep.
And so that's the first thing we're doing. I think the second thing we're doing is we observe a lot of fashion brands, mainstream fashion brands, running kind of hit or miss, pay to play, or one-off kind of collaborations, if you like, with megastars, mega talent.
Yep.
And, you know, we're very fortunate. We have strong budgets. We have, you know, a lot to spend on marketing this year, but that's not what we want to do. Very, very clearly, myself and Vanessa Spence, who's our chief creative officer, that isn't what we want to do. You know, what we want to do is build long-term relationships with people who feel really passionately about fashion, as passionately as we feel about fashion. And if those are kind of at the micro or mid-tier end, that's great. You know, we'll work with them, we'll build relationships with them. And so Our focus this year is very much on building a extremely strong pipeline of ASOS talent, basically. We've just released a new campaign this week, which is called ASOS Your Way, which is our first version of that. And, you know, some of the people that we're working with for that campaign, it's a talent-led campaign. And some of the people we're working with, like Josh Ryan, for example, you know, they're thrilled. They're completely thrilled to be working with ASOS. Josh said to us, Josh has got kind of 4 million followers on TikTok. And he was saying to us that he's written to ASOS 5 times over the last kind of 4 or 5 years to work with us and just hasn't been able to find a response. And so that's what we want. We want to work with, you know, he is mega talent, obviously, but we want to work with creators at all levels who feel as passionately about our brand as we do. So that's, you know, that's where we're focused at the moment. There is also a big branded content play. There's always going to be a role for branded content, but we're kind of building those muscles at the same time.
Well, I mean, that's the way that you describe it is the way that I would do it, right? And so I think that I'm excited to see the results. And obviously, I think there is an incredible amount of love for the brand, right? Both the kind of the retailer and the sub brands. So I think I'm excited to see what you guys do. I'm curious, before we get, I'll do one fun kind of end of show question. How did Google think about creators? How did the CMOs, and maybe what were some of the aspects of the kind of CMOs that you think were the best? Because you were there fairly recently.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting question. And look, I will caveat it by saying that I worked in one office in one team at Google. I don't think anyone except for Sundar sees Google in its entirety. And I'm not just saying this because I work there and I have a lot of friends there. It's my firm belief that YouTube is, you know, the best video media platform out there. I think it's got the best content and it's got the most engaged eyeballs. So I do think it is the best media platform. Honestly, though, Connor, like when I was at Google, the conversations we had with CMOs time and time again was, you know, how do we get on board with this? And I think at the time that I was there, Google came at advertising and partnerships with creators on YouTube at the same way that it came at almost all of its ad products, which was, you know, how can we monetize this as quickly and as broadly as possible? Mm-hmm. And we probably weren't as successful at partnering, kind of creating three-way partnerships between creators, brands, and YouTube as you could have been. So I think we kind of felt outflanked there a little bit by some of the other platforms.
Yep.
But, you know, like I say, the best content is still on that platform, I think. And it's just a question of, you know, like finding a way to build kind of sustainable partnerships there.
To your point, the amount of time spent on YouTube is just so unfathomable. It's like, I can't remember the stat. I think it's from like 2 or 3 years ago, but people spend 1 billion hours a day on YouTube. Like 1 billion hours a day. And that was like a big goal internally, supposedly, within YouTube. And so it's just like, I mean, it's just so much time. So there's got to be, I mean, there's clearly a reason that people are spending that much time. I think if you were to look at the creator space more broadly, in terms of where content is being created in the brand space, it's really kind of Instagram in the lead, and then TikTok, and then YouTube, depending upon the channel and depending upon the kind of the category, right? So like for gaming, Instagram isn't as big, but for beauty and fashion and travel and whatever, Instagram's bigger than the other two. And TikTok's growing very, very quickly right now. So one of the things that we've been observing was you had kind of the user growth spike on TikTok over the last, call it 2-3 years, but the content about brands wasn't growing at the same rate. And then what's happened is I think that this kind of generation of creators on TikTok is going, looking around saying, hey, I've got 500,000 fans or 1 million fans. How do I start actually making some money on this, right? How do I do that? And they're realizing that if they, you know, release their own barbecue sauce or start working collaboratively on a new collection, right? That this is the way that they actually make money and that they need to talk brands. You know, that needs to be a percentage of their content in order to properly monetize, because that's where most of the money is on the brand side and in the marketing side. And so with a lot of our categories, we're seeing TikTok grow in EMV like 100, 200% year over year is very, very, very fast. So that's kind of what we're seeing in terms of channels. I think generally from a content and time perspective, you know, TikTok really caught Meta and YouTube flat-footed with the kind of short form video content. So short videos typically tied to music or obviously some kind of sound, but they're rapidly catching up. So if you look at the earnings statements of Meta and Google, you know, I think Instagram Reels, which is the competitor product to TikTok, is growing well over 100% year over year in time spent and in revenue. And YouTube Shorts is also growing well over 100% year over year in time spent and revenue. So we'll see. We'll see what ends up happening. But that's generally where it's at right now in terms of the data. Well, let's do one fun end of show question. So there is a lot about Dan Elton, the working professional, but I'm curious, how does Dan Elton spend his time when he's not dominating the marketing landscape? What do you do outside of work?
Great question. So I've got two small kids who are 8 and 6. And for those with kids, they will know that that's an age where it's like, you're on the cusp of moving, particularly for my 8-year-old, you're on the cusp of moving out of the really kind of early childhood, and they'll be teenagers before you know it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Right now, I'm trying to hang on to every moment with my son and daughter where they are still tiny and enjoying being with me. And I know that sounds a bit depressing, but I actually love it. So I'm trying to be very mindful about that. The other thing, jokes aside about that, like, I am a middle-aged cliche, Connor. So during COVID, I got hugely into cycling.
Oh, cool.
And there you go. In all of my spare time, I try and cycle. I love cycling. I love cycling indoors. I've got Zwift. I don't know if you know Zwift or are a fan of Zwift. It's kind of an indoor cycling app. It's incredible. Another kind of COVID boom story. And outdoors when I can. I mean, in London, it's hard to get outdoors too much in the winter, but it's just an incredible way to blow off steam, get some time to think. Great for your mental health. So yeah, so time between kids and cycling.
There you go. Yeah, I've got a 1-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 5-year-old. I am rapidly approaching the ages you're talking about. I'm excited, but I think to your point, it's like you blink, you're like, wait, how did this year pass? How did these 2 years pass? Like, what is happening? It kind of becomes a blur. So,
yeah, it does. And you got to hang on to it. You know, I think it could be exhausting when you're in it, but it's wonderful and it'll be gone quickly. So
Totally. I literally saw a guy last night and he's like, the days are long, but the years are short, right? That's the way they describe this time in life. Well, Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time and congrats again on all your personal success. I'm so excited to see what you guys accomplish with ASOS. I think the palette is there to really crush it. And I think you guys are going to, based on my knowledge and my conversations with you. And so good luck. And yeah, I'll see you soon.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.